Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
John, how are you, buddy?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
Good, I'm doing well. Have you got a Captain America shield in the back?
I do. Look what
is that my fucking sword?
Yes, it is.
I don't even have one of those.
That's amazing.
And wow. It's the one that's all chipped up on the side.
No Dude. Way, it was an actual fighting one, huh?
I got a bunch of stuff from the auction.
Oh, no
two
way.
Two swords, which I gave one away to charity for a charity auction.
Nice.
Then a couple of Stellas that I gave to the writing staff that I knew.
Oh, that's amazing.
Taylor actually has yours, Kat.
No way.
Wow.
That's so cool.
They took mine away from me. We've talked about this on the podcast quite a bit, but because I broke so many in season one, I just mystically didn't have one.
Because everything in season one was just a little fragile.
Yeah. No
I don't
kidding.
Know what you're talking about, John.
Us included, it turns out. John, it's such a pleasure to have you on. Thank you for taking
it
the
is.
Time
Thank
to
you.
Come and chat to us.
Happy to be a part of this all.
Absolutely. Well, welcome back, folks, to Return to the Shadows. Today, we have a very special guest, one of the magical people behind the scenes of our show who we truly could not have done this without, John Rakich, our location manager. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be a part of the show. Come on the podcast.
And be part of the show, hopefully.
Well,
and part of the show. I have to correct something. Technically, I think I'm one of the three long people that have been on the show longer than anyone else.
Yeah.
So the show started filming in August. I started in March of that year.
Yeah.
There you go. You were hired before us.
Yeah, actually, we were. I remember when they were trying to cast you.
Wow.
Can I make it even weirder? Yeah. I was a location scout in the movie.
Whoa.
Well, I did know that. Yeah, I knew that you were the location scout in the movie because I feel like we've spoken about that at some point because we doubled some of the locations, right? Like we changed them.
A but few.
We. Yeah, yeah, there was a couple that were used in
not,
both.
Not too many, thankfully.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's wild. There was a few things in season one I remember that we used in both that were very quickly in season two. Not locations, but like the swords. The swords were swords from the movie.
The swords, the props,
mm-hmm.
The glass in the Institute actually was recycled from another movie.
Oh, wow.
No way. Do you know what the movie was?
Resident Evil 5.
No way.
4.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Because Constantine.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That all the there was a huge set we had where Mila runs through a tunnel of glass, and they spent a lot of money on all this glass, so they put it in storage. And so when it came time to build this set, they went, we have this glass. And nobody thought that it wasn't the right glass. It wasn't gimbaled, which is why we had all those reflection problems.
Mm. Right.
And the heat.
Yeah. And
yes,
the heat.
That too.
Just let's we just make an oven and put everyone inside it.
Yeah. Who knew?
Oh my goodness.
Who knew? It's just the things you figure out when you're on set.
But it was the hilarious thing is when we saw these trailers come in that said RE on them. Like, what is... And then the stuff from the Mortal Instruments, they basically just recycled as much as they could because they kept it all.
You might as well, you know?
Yeah.
It's already got all the runes on it.
And then season two, we got rid of it all and fixed it.
Yeah. Before we dive headlong into a reunion that we've all been longing to have, John, why don't you tell everyone at home what your position was on Shadowhunters, what you did, what your day-to-day was?
So I was hired as the location manager for pretty much almost all the show, which I can cover later. So the job of location manager is we basically take the script and the concept and the ideas that the writers, the producers have, and the production designer, and find practical real-world locations to film this in, to make it part of the story, part of the character. So that literally was my job, was to get the script, to break it down and pitch ideas that we then see whether they work or not. And then being television, we then, since we had most of the scripts, we could see what we would go to enough times necessary to build, what was going to be on location. And then literally with the creatives, try to find things that work for the story, the look. And then once we secure all that, the location department job changes very much from creative to logistics. We're then responsible for permits, permissions, where the unit goes, where everyone eats, where the bathrooms go, all the unsexy parts of the actual making of a production.
But,
wow.
And so it's interesting. We've had a few different crew members on over the course of, and very often that same phrase kind of gets recycled with crew, right? Very often it's the, you know, this is the unsexy behind the scenes part. But what people need to realize is that TV shows aren't made without these unsexy parts. Like, they just don't function.
Yep.
It's true.
I was on a TV show that'll remain nameless, and how long ago will remain nameless, because otherwise you can backtrack and be like, oh, he did this 6 years ago. This is exactly what it was. It wasn't 6 years ago. That's not what I'm talking about. But they didn't didn't have crew bathrooms. We were shooting on a New York street, and we were filming somewhere quite far away from that, and it brought everything kind of to a halt when we'd figured it out, like, well, this, or, you know, this needs to change. And a couple of the other actors were very, very stringent, like, this is something that needs to change. But it does, it grinds everything to a halt all of a sudden. So without all of these, you know, I can't say it enough, I've said it before, I'll sound like a broken record, but without people like John, these shows don't get made. There's you know, the actors and the directors and the producers get so much credit for being on a TV show, but like John says, our job started months after his job started. You know what I mean? Like, and even you could say, because you recycled so much stuff, you're in a way still on that job. Like, it's still thinking about Shadowhunters, like, oh, I wonder if we have some stuff there that we could use on this next thing or take to this next thing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Again, the location manager in the department usually is one of the first ones hired. Mm-hmm. And usually they're the last ones there. So I, you know, from cradle to grave, we're involved in every aspect. My department, the bathroom thing, that grinds to a halt. 150 people need to go somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the funny thing is, here where we're based out of, there's actually law we have to follow. I have a mathematical table that I have to keep of how many people we have, how many actual holes, as they're referred to, we have to have to
necessitate
that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. How many holes
and
do
it's,
we need?
I've been on some shows where that number got huge. Yeah. And, you know, the last thing you need is all of a sudden a lineup of 30 people trying to get into a port-a-john.
Totally.
Because we're trying to shoot. Where is the director? Well, he's waiting in line. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That doesn't fly well. The biggest detriment to production is the loss of time.
Yeah. Well, and truly, it's so many aspects of production, from the creative to the logistic, is all problem solving. And it takes creativity, and it takes, you know, a knowledge base and experience and everything that, you know, you clearly have become so well versed in to figure it out. So whether it's, you know, as Dom said, the unsexy parts of filmmaking or not, it's all so necessary and so instrumental to, you know, doing the flips and things that we all love.
Yeah. Even just, you know, our biggest challenge sometimes is where they want to put lights.
Yeah.
You know, a DP points and goes, I want a light on that roof. Well, we don't know if we can get up there.
It's not right. Our roof. Yeah, we can't do that.
It's not our roof. We just can't just walk. I just can't walk up there with a cord. It takes time. And, you know, yeah, as you said, it's a lot of little moving pieces for what everyone ends up watching on screen that they don't see behind stage. And my department is one of the ones that actually interacts with everyone's.
Yeah.
There's not an aspect of production that somehow doesn't cross, like, even where the hair and makeup decides to sit, put their chair down.
Mm-hmm. Has to be locations.
That can end up being, you know, something to deal with.
Well, so that sort of leads into my first question. We get these cheat sheets. We get these brilliant cheat sheets, and it's got all of this information and, like, you know, stuff that we should ask and whatever. And I look at that zero, and I think of questions, and that's what I do. It's very similar to how I work on set, John. So question number one. And this has always fascinated me, and I've never really found the time to ask the question, because when we're shooting on like a busy street, like, you know, in Toronto, Yonge, I think we had shut down for a second there. What does that entail? Because that's, you know, we're shutting down a huge section of the metropolitan area of Toronto. And for anyone who's been to or lives in Toronto, they have sort of a semi one-way system. So every other street kind of goes one way throughout the metropolitan. So shutting down one of those really does make a huge fucking issue. It's a real problem in Toronto. So tell me a little about that.
Sure. I mean, the greatest thing is that I'm based, you know, Toronto's a city where the actual city is a good partner with us in production. We tell them what we want to do, and they kind of help us figure out the best way to do it. So when we did shut down the section of Yonge Street, which is a main arterial road, we always knew from the beginning that it's going to have to be on a weekend. Mm-hmm. But the only way they'll let us do it is on a Saturday or a Sunday when there's less traffic or you're less impediment to business. Mm-hmm. So it then just literally becomes us working with the city, the fire department, transit, everyone to make sure that we're not impacting our schedule works for theirs. The neighbors, the residents all know and got on board and let us do what we did, which is basically shut down a block and a half of a major street and reroute traffic. The funny thing was, that's actually one of the few locations where that was Matt Hastings' episode. He and I got into a disagreement over that one, and I'm glad I won.
Really?
Early on in that season, he walked into my office and said, "Finale, Avengers battle on the streets," and he walked away. Which he would do routinely. He would just throw things to give us a heads up. So we started pitching stuff, and we took them downtown and went, well, there's this corner, there's this block, there's this block. And they didn't want to work on a Saturday because it required shifting the crew schedule. And then the idea was we'd just build it in the parking lot with green screen. Just green screen, which to me is like a knife in the heart.
Yeah.
Because it's never going to look right. You're never going to have – VisFX can do the world, but you can't get that sense of scale as much as you want to try. And what happened was, Kat, you had a conflict that meant you had a Saturday available because we had to get you off something faster at that point.
That's when I was going to Maze Runner.
Yeah, and that's literally why all of a sudden no one was fighting about being on a Saturday. And that was like, we'll do it in the back parking lot. And I literally politely argued and said, it was the dumbest idea you're going to ever have. We can do it now.
Yeah.
We should just do so. We did, and it was brilliant. It looked phenomenal.
Happy to.
I mean, we staged a traffic jam, which was even smarter because parking lots are expensive downtown. Mm-hmm. So that traffic jam was pretty much most of the crew's cars parked on the middle of the street.
Really?
That's amazing. Really, that I didn't know.
Aside from the taxis and the buses, most of the cars there because. Although, if you think about it, that scene is just 2 minutes long in a traffic jam in New York City. Although a lot happens in it, so the cars never have to move. So we just basically stack crew cars, put in picture cars. Because if you watch the scene, no vehicles ever move through it.
No, that's true.
No, they don't. So that
was
you're right.
It was free cars.
So
and
brilliant.
At the end of the day, the scene looked brilliant.
It did.
Oh, yeah. It's one of the best scenes. And it gets, you know, replayed and re-edited over and over again.
Mm-hmm. That's in my personal reel. I got footage from them for it. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, because it has that scale. And because you feel the city and you feel that kind of open expanse of space.
Mm-hmm. And then we got the drone to go around the buildings. It just looked brilliant.
Yeah.
So, again, in that case, much like any road closure, the city really was helpful with us when we explained what we wanted to do. And they gave us the permission. And the storefronts all, you know, that we covered up were all happy. No one was really put out.
Canadians are nice as well, though.
Yeah.
That's a big part
of
it. Canadians
Canada.
Are nice. You know what I mean? Like we filmed the most recent show I just finished was we filmed in New York and we did a lot of stuff on the streets. And we do things, and John, obviously, Kat, you guys all know about this, but for the listeners at home who may not know about this, it's called a lock off, which John mentioned briefly. And you literally lock off for both traffic cars and traffic walking traffic. Mm-hmm. You lock off two sections of the street, the top and the end, and people can't travel through those. But correct me if I'm wrong, legally, we're not allowed to stop pedestrians from walking. Right.
Correct. A police officer can, or a barricade, but you can ask someone to stop.
But they
I guarantee you, I know New York like the back of my hand.
Yeah.
No New Yorker is going to stop.
Nope.
He's going to go right through into
no.
With some very colorful language.
Morning scenes. Yeah, no kidding. We had a couple, like, we had a great Steadicam operator, Patrick. And there were a couple moments where someone said something a little colorful to me on the way, and camera just goes straight up to the sky. Like, we're not seeing any of that. This is a Netflix show. We can't have that in there. We'll bring it back down when we're ready to go. But yeah, New Yorkers are less.
Now, we
less
did the common. Opposite, though, with you, Kat, when we did when Matt wanted to get a scene of you walking through a crowded street.
Yeah,
so we literally,
I remember that.
I was there that day. There was three of, it was a camera operator, a grip, Matt, myself, and a costume person. Mm-hmm. And we just threw you in morning traffic,
yep.
morning rush hour pedestrian traffic,
yep.
but mostly them all going the other way.
Yeah.
So that they weren't looking at the camera and it worked. It was like the opposite work and nobody cared
because no,
they were
great.
Just in a rush to get to work.
Yeah. Cause there's a, you know, you put up a little sandwich placard on the street that says.
We didn't even do that.
Oh, you didn't? I thought I was.
No, we literally created a wedge behind the camera of our bodies so people would have to go around it.
Oh my God.
Past you.
So wow. For the listeners at home, this was the scene where in, I think it's season 2, episode 1, when Clary has decided to run away from the shadow world because she feels like she doesn't belong anywhere and run
fucking
back
Clary.
To the Brooklyn Academy of Art. I know she loves to run
what
away
from
various times. But it was by Union Station in Toronto downtown, which as you know, if anyone has ever been to Toronto or has ever been near a Union Station in any city in the morning,
yeah.
it's so the streets are packed and you know, you can't get between people's shoulders. And it made for such an amazing scene because you just had this sea of coats and people and faces. And, yeah, I remember it was such kind of guerrilla filmmaking, but in the best way.
Us and two vans. That was it. Yeah.
Yeah. We love that, though. We've said on this podcast, we're sort of approaching the end of this season now. So we've
yeah.
talked extensively about the show. So if I'm repeating myself, listeners, I apologize. But we've spoken quite extensively about the difference between shooting, for example, on a green screen, especially the 360 green screen, which is quite hard work because on a show like ours is very hard work because we're imagining these things that we haven't even seen. It's not like a dragon. It's
yeah.
like a mythical beast and we don't know what the fuck that thing's going to look like. So you're imagining this thing
mm-hmm.
or this world or whatever, you know, Eden, whatever it is. And we have no concept of what that's going to look like, which is really hard work. And at least for me, the most exciting days are out on the street. There are because I can see everything. I can visualize everything. And it takes this little element of difficulty out of my workday. It adds difficulty to your workday, I'm sure. But it takes a little out of mine.
It keeps me employed.
It keeps you employed, yeah.
But the truth, the location becomes a character in the story.
It does.
Sure.
And if you think of like iconic movies and iconic scenes, where they take place, even if it's fictitiously you know, created, like Toronto became New York, yeah. it's still a character and everything.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, if for anyone who's read the books and for anyone who, you know, has watched the show, the city of New York in any piece of media becomes such a huge character in it and mm-hmm. takes on kind of a life of its own and is a, you know, mythical being in and of itself. But,
yeah,
you know,
no
kidding. It felt as though, and I'm sure this is largely due to you, we found such a great rhythm on the show of having most of the time in studio and on stages when we had our own space and our own stuff and then being able to use the rest of our resources to go out and do some really major, huge locations. And, you know, I didn't know this when I moved to Toronto, but even some of the locations we used in the pilot, like the Distillery District and that nightclub and all those things, those are pretty prominent and usually very busy Toronto locations.
Oh yeah, I'm banned
yeah,
from
I
that.
I won't
nightclub.
Lie and say when the Distillery District was pitched by McGee, a lot of us just kind of hung our heads, going,
yeah.
"Okay, oh, it's a no. real pain to go there."
Yeah,
but fine. Because well, for those who don't know it, it was an old distillery that got gentrified. It's surrounded by condominiums and shops and restaurants. It's the residents that's always an issue,
yeah.
but we made it work. It was just it wasn't our favorite place to pitch.
Mm.
Truthfully, the hardest day on the first episode was the pre-shoot day. The park we were in was just I don't even know if I even made it, but that was like we had a pre-shoot day of a Clary flashback with a demon coming out of water that was
yeah,
in
yeah,
park
it's in
that
the pilot.
The fountain didn't work
yeah,
and we had to literally crack a fire hydrant to put water in this thing
no
again.
No way.
Yeah, the actual mechanics of the park's fountain didn't work. They couldn't get water to it, so we actually got to crack a hydrant with permission and run
of course,
a hose
yeah.
to fill this thing up.
Wow.
But the nightclub, you mean the nightclub with the incessant fire alarm that kept going off?
Oh, yeah. I'd forgotten about that.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, three times that one night. Because
yeah.
every time they opened the doors, the smoke would billow, the atmospheric smoke that we used to make everything look pretty and sexy. When you fill the room, so it's like a pressured room. And we opened the doors, that smoke would fly out and go two floors up in the same building, go into the intake and set off the fire alarm. Because the owner of the building didn't want to disable the system until the third call from the fire department. And then he flicked the switch.
Right. Wild.
But
yikes.
That was, you know, finding the club was interesting because we tried to avoid certain things from the movie. So it's a different, like we found about the club we were in had the little alleyway and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to jump ahead to the last episode. I really fought. I wasn't on the last two. I was kind of there free. I was doing another show waiting for season four to get greenlit,
right.
And it didn't. Right. I was in the same building doing this horrible Christmas movie for Freeform. I couldn't leave. So I was still kind of involved. And when I saw the last two scripts, I kept arguing that the very, very last scene of the show should have been in the same alley from the first episode of The Nightclub.
That would have been cool.
Been nice.
It's that the end is the beginning is the end.
Yeah.
It just never ended up happening because of their schedule. And I kept arguing with them going, it makes more sense. Even Todd agreed, but it just wouldn't work.
Just couldn't figure it out.
Bummer.
Yeah.
That happens a lot. There's stuff that we really think might work in pitch, and it gets being creative and it's other people's inputs. Other things end up being decided.
There's so many voices. It's nuts. Like it's, you know, auditioning for us is it's sort of a similar process. Like you impress one person who's normally the first person you meet, like a casting director or a casting associate. Great, you've impressed that person. Then maybe you impress a series of producers or the director. But then there's the money people. Then there's like the heads of the studio, the heads of the network. Like there's these groups. Tests, do you remember what tests used to be like? Our test for Shadowhunters?
I miss
it. You sit in a theater. You sit in like an auditorium and you have 40 people who work for Disney and Freeform and then people who work for Constantine. All of the people who have these sort of career-defining moments in their hands. And if one of them says no, that is then thrown into question. It's a real big, like, we don't know. And it's nightmarish.
I prefer that. Yeah, I prefer that to the Zoom screen test.
I prefer it to Zooms, but now I'm sort of getting into a bit of a rhythm with Zoom, I think. I'm like, anyway, that's boring. This isn't about John. We need to talk more about
that another time. We won't waste your time with that, John.
During COVID, I was on a show. We decided to do an in-person production meeting with COVID protocols, which basically involved 75 of us standing in a studio around the perimeter yelling at one another.
That is
We went back to Zoom very quickly.
Yeah,
I bet
sure.
So.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because, God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout. And woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to know how one gets to be a location manager. How did you find this career path and what led you to this job?
Okay. So I'm going to have to go back in time. I was living the dream, living in my parents' basement. Working at a record store, if you can remember what those were.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Highlight. My sister actually was in the film industry for a while as an assistant director, and she was on a TV show where they had fired their fifth office PA and said, well, my brother can do it if these people can. So that's how I got into the business. And I didn't know what I wanted to be. And my office was next to the location's office, and they all sounded like they were, you know, batshit crazy and having a lot of fun. And I started talking to them. And the first job I got, you start at the bottom, like as a location PA, setting up tables, chairs, garbage cans. The first job I was given by a location manager named Richard Hughes, who was the other location manager on Shadowhunters, because I made them hire him.
Aww.
So that was it. I fell into it. I did a good job. People started hiring me more. Someone on a show once said, hey, do you know how to location scout? And I went, no. And they went, well, you grab a camera and take some photos. So I scouted for a long time, worked my way up to an assistant location manager. And then funny enough, while I was waiting to start officially, because I scouted for the movie in pre-production, took the directors around, and then there was a lull until they were going to get greenlit. That was where I actually got an offer to location manage my first show ever, which was a show for Netflix called Hemlock Grove.
Oh, cool.
It kind of just fell into it, and you know, I have an aptitude for it, I guess, and it's something I enjoy doing. And you know, what was going to be a part-time job just to make some money has now been a 25-year career.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I like the puzzle. I like the creative puzzle and then the logistical puzzle.
Yeah.
Cool.
So like you said, it's a lot of problem solving on both ends, and it's a lot of juggling, because people have to realize while we're doing one day, we're also setting up three more and then, you know, wrapping out yesterday. So it's a constant movement, especially on television.
Yeah, no kidding. Like,
once the ball rolls, you don't have a break.
Well, fuck, man. We moved so quickly on that show. Like for the amount that we did with, like, you know, flat packing sets. So like indoors, for people listening at home, indoors, when these sets are all, so inside they look spectacular. They look like the room, like it's absolutely amazing. The second you leave them, they are like plywood, like there's like nails sticking out, and they're all designed to go completely flat very quickly, go in the back of a truck and then go to somewhere else. That's what they're designed to do. And so we had that with sets coming up and down. We had the stunts, we had CGI everywhere, and I think the longest episode other than the pilot, which took a month, but we never spent more than 2 weeks on an episode, which is insane when you think
they
about
were eight
it
days,
like absolutely
right?
insane
eight
episodes
days.
Yes, 16 days per episode, 8 to get it ready, 8 to get it done.
Jeez. And
people realize, although you have 8 days to get it ready, you really only have 6.
Yeah,
because if by day 7 and 8 you're not ready to lock everything in, you're
because 6 and 7 or 5 and 6 would be like your tech scouts, right? Like you're actually physically going to the place.
Oh, yeah, easily. And so, you know, you're lucky. On season 1, it was, you get the earlier we get scripts that everyone gets them, the better it is for us, the more we can get ahead of things. But then, you know, we don't see the director of that episode until the first day of prep, and he might have different ideas for everything that we've already agreed on.
Oh, yeah.
We were lucky on Shadowhunters that we didn't have that much, but I've been on some shows where the director walks in and everything gets wiped out that you'd spent the last 2 weeks pre-planning
because
he's got a different idea.
Can you imagine?
Oh my.
What a nightmare.
You have the patience
of a saint.
There
was a show I worked on that I will not name, but this director, that was what he was known for, and he enjoyed doing it. He enjoyed coming in and causing chaos, and he would just sit there and giggle.
Ugh. We have no room for chaos goblins in television.
No. We were lucky. I mean, we had scripts as early as we could. Season 3 was even better because I was, at that point, we knew Todd Darren. I'd met the writers at Comic-Con. They actually gave me access to their notes. So I was one of the few people that knew more about what you guys were going to go through than anybody else, because I actually had access to their handwritten notes and their actual meetings. Just because where it gets more collaborative is nothing worse than we get a script and it's like, well, we really don't have that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If we can pitch, like, tell me what you're looking for. We could pitch something else.
Right.
Because there was an episode where they wanted to shoot it on the Staten Island Ferry. And I'm like, we don't have the Staten Island Ferry.
No. Yeah.
Oh, I remember that. I remember it getting nixed. And I remember it being like, oh, fuck, that would have been really cool.
No, it ended up becoming a cemetery.
Yeah. It was the cemetery in the end. Yeah.
And then there were some scenes where it's like, it's, you know, how many times can we be in a park? Can we just think of something else?
Right.
Yeah.
The best example is that one season that we ended up shooting at the St. Lawrence Market.
Oh, yeah.
That was actually scripted to be in a park.
Oh, wait. I remember this.
It was in a park and we were driving with Matt. We were driving on a location scout back to look at some stuff.
Yeah.
It was Mike McMurray, myself. It wasn't actually Mike. I can't remember who was DPing that. But Matt was in the van. We drove by St. Lawrence Market. He went, what's that? Went, St. Lawrence Market. You want to go take a look? Sure. And he looked at me and, can we film here? I went, yeah, they're closed on Mondays. Okay, then can we shoot? And we did. We ended up changing that whole scene to be in that market with, you know, flying demons and stalls being broken open.
Well, and that ended up being so much cooler. I don't know if you remember, Dom, that was the scene that there was the big wraith demon that I was chasing down and shooting.
Yeah, you want me, come and get me, right? The big, big trailer line. Yeah. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah.
But even the werewolf being tossed into the cabinet, the windows being smashed, there was so much that came out of just one spot that we drove by and thought this would work better than a park.
And see, I love what you mentioned about the writer's notes, because this is something that we talk about a lot on the podcast, but that's just another example of, you know, often on TV shows, people don't end up sharing, or in anything in entertainment or most workplaces, people don't often share resources or information as much as they could. But simply by telling you what's going on and keeping you in the loop and giving you information and having that sort of round table, open door policy that we had on Shadowhunters with all the departments, it added so much to the show and it allowed everyone to do work that was so much more elevated because we were just informed. And that's, you know, that's something that I wish was more common of, you know, just having anyone being able to get information.
Any industry,
whether it's,
just in life, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I agree.
But it just shows how it can be when it's fully collaborative.
Yeah.
It just becomes more enjoyable, more of an art form, more of everyone putting the best they can out there. Even like The Garden season 3, that was 2 months of us trying to figure out what that was going to be between, is it this set? Is it that? Do we build it? What do we need? And then settled on the ruins that we ended up being at.
That's so cool.
Amazing. That actually, so that collaboration leads me to my next question. So, people at home, there are many, many instances where we've built a set and the set has a front door. So as soon as you leave that front door, you're outside somewhere. And that has to be, unless we build an outside set, that has to be, which the Hunter's Moon had, you know, we built that entire street, which is incredible. Like the whole street of Chinatown, like 2 blocks each way or a block each way, which is just fucking wild. But like the Jade Wolf is a good example. When you leave the set of the Jade Wolf, you're on the docks, which is outside, which obviously for us was relatively easy. But what is that like? What is that dance with you between a set deck, right? Like I imagine those guys, or not set deck, who builds sets? What department builds sets?
I mean, construction based on the art department. But usually the question is when you go outside, what is outside? So, you know, and usually you try to go to the script to pull out as much information. What city is it in? Where does it take place? What's around there? And if you can't, then that's when you have conversations with the showrunners, you know, other producers, the designer, you know, where in, because it was New York, where in New York is this? Okay, so what does it want to look like? Like, which part of the city are we thinking of? Because that even drives things like the subway set, what subway sign will be on there. So you walk out a door, you know, let's take season 1, The Loft.
Yeah.
And the antique shop, which is a place that we all hated. we needed a 2-story building that looked interesting. And we actually found this wretched place that the owner was a hoarder on the 3rd floor. But thankfully, we never went back there again.
God,
and
that's I remember that. It, like, you turned up and it was a nightmare, right?
Yeah. He no longer lives there. And it's now being turned into some swanky condominium with still maintaining the base of it. But yeah, that's like what is outside is just as important look-wise because it also drives what set deck will dress it as, what, you know, picture cars will be there because that, I mean, I spent a lot of time in New York and I was always arguing, well, if we're in Brooklyn, the cabs can't be yellow. They're supposed to be green because you get the stock cars that are, you know, and they're not Crown Vicks. They're this. So if you wanted to make it real, you really kind of get a sense of where, like, you know, where was the Institute, which church is it really supposed to be?
Right.
Are we going by what's in the books? Are we going by what we decided by the stock shots that we bought?
Right.
Because that drives everything. So it's, yeah, even just opening the door becomes a
huge thing. Yeah. Right. I did a movie, where it's not out. Well, actually it was all done on location. We weren't in the studio at all. We had 2 different sets for breaching and clearing a room. We played a US Marshal, so breaching and clearing a room, and then we go down into the basement. So the upstairs room was one set and the basement was a completely different place. And when we got there, we realized that the door opened the other way. We're like, fuck, this is a real fucking problem because we can't change it. There's nothing we can do. Go and rewatch the movie. The door is, they took it completely off the hinges and it's just rested already open on the other side.
That's happened to me in the past. We've shot the stage component first, then we go on the location, the door's on the wrong side. Yeah. So we have to remove the door.
You move the door. Yeah. Like if you have the time, you move the door.
Take it out, hang it the other way.
Yeah. There you go.
No choice. It's I can't remember if it was Spielberg or Scorsese who said recently that it's being on a set, being a director or actor, you know, locations, whatever it is, like it's problem solving. That's what you do. And you need, the better you get at it, the quicker you get at it, the more you're going to progress in your career. Like you get good at solving whatever this issue is. What is this issue? It's a door. Great. We take it off. We put it on the other side. Amazing. Done. That problem's taken care of. You know, is it nighttime or daytime? We need to fix that problem. Okay, great. We do it like this and it's fixed, you know.
Other shows, you show up on a set and the director goes, oh, I don't want to look that way anymore. I want to look that way. And it's just, we're not set. Okay, great. How do we do that quickly?
Mm-hmm. Or an actor comes on set and goes, I just feel like I need to walk over here on this line. And everyone's going.
The face of knowing from John is just, yeah.
Mm-hmm, yep. Uh-huh. Yep. Uh-huh. Every time.
But I did a show where our director of photography wasn't able to ever come scouting with us. And he would show up each day going, why are we here? Well, we're filming that.
No way.
Well, I don't like that. I want to be over there. I want to be down the street.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Because by the time we show up, that decision has been gone through several people. And several, you know, money has been spent on equipment, gear, people, getting things ready.
Yeah.
Well, and then the simple things as well. Like this question then needs to go back to the writers. And we were in Toronto, the writers were in LA. So if we show up at 8 a.m, it's 5 a.m. in LA. Yeah. So they're not up yet. So how do we answer that question? Do we wait for 5 hours and lose $100,000 an hour while we're renting this set? Like, no.
Yeah, that was the funny thing in season 1 is that the people that were behind it, you know, behind the scenes, hadn't really done episodic television a lot. So they didn't see the benefit of having a showrunner or directing producer.
I see.
And that's what the explanation was. It's 6 a.m. when we have to figure out whether this is blue or green. Who we calling?
Right.
Yeah.
And they went, huh? I'm like, well, you have to have someone here who can creatively have the power to make that decision.
You need someone who can pull
triggers. Unless half those writers are here with us, you know, which I did a series called The Expanse where half the producing team was always in town. So we always had answers right away.
A very dear friend of mine is on The Expanse, Dominique Tipper.
Yeah. Yes.
I did one of my first big movies with Dominique. She's fucking
wonderful. And the funny thing was for science, one of the producers was actually an astrophysicist.
Oh,
really? So he could actually, he decided he didn't want to do that and wanted to be a movie producer. And but he could always answer like all the techie questions right off the bat. We never questioned if he was making it up because we just assumed he was right.
Well, yeah, I mean, at that point,
you need to have someone there that can make that call. And if you know, that's why the directing producer on television shows is such a valuable and an important position to have.
Absolutely.
Like Matt on season 2 and 3 just steered the ship from the rocks all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was just so good at being able to just make executive decisions and at any juncture. But on that note, I have to ask, what is, and it can be maybe on Shadowhunters, maybe this is a two-part question, on Shadowhunters and then just in general, what is the wildest problem that you've encountered or thing, most unique thing you've had to find, and how did you solve the problem?
Okay, wildest? There's two. One was, I can't remember what show it was. We were going to film at this really ratty, divey house at the end of the day, and we found out there was bed bugs in one of the rooms.
Oh no!
So we had to get the bed bugs. And it turned out it was in the son's room, who was a bit of a slob in the mattress. But we had to get an exterminator to come in quickly.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is hard to do. And they found no word of a lie. They found a father and son Christian exterminating team.
Wow.
Never heard of that before. And they got the job done, and the crew was informed and said, "Look, if you really don't feel safe, then don't go in." But we did the job. The most bizarre one. Resident Evil 3, we needed to do a scene on a beach with a helicopter.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Right at the beginning, right?
Yeah. It's
a flashback to a scene from another one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She walks through an airplane graveyard and there's a helicopter and a bunch of flashbacks. The helicopter never flies. The director fell in love with this tree in this beach 3.5 hours away from Toronto in the Sandbank Provincial Park. The producers... fought for us to find another spot that was closer. No, he had to have this tree, this beach. And we had been in discussions with the park. It's a provincial park, like a state-run park, with the park superintendent about the plan was, we're going to fly this helicopter and land it just because it's easier for us to fly it there than put it on a trailer and crane it. Mm-hmm. Everything was fine. About 4 weeks before we're supposed to film, the park superintendent says, oh, you know, you can't land a helicopter there. Like, we've been talking about this for 5 weeks. Oh, I didn't realize that. So we go back to the producer whose answer was, we'll fix it. So we ended up, I was the assistant on the show, ended up going through the park, like park law, literally going through like what's called the Parks Act of Ontario to find out why I can land one here and not here. And it was because it was by the water and had a road. It was bizarre stuff, but we found a loophole saying that the minister for Parks and Recreation could amend that law. So then we did. We literally found a way to get someone. It's not easy to get in front of politicians to get it. It turned out someone from Toronto City Council was going to be in a car with them to some conference. And we kind of gave her our notes and they pitched it and explained, like, this is why we're doing this. And all I remember getting is a phone call from the park superintendent 3 weeks later going, I don't know what you did, but you got your permission. And there is literally a line in the act that at that time there was a 3-day window of change. The law was amended for 3 days only to land a helicopter on this beach. Now, did anyone from the crew know that when they show up? No. Did the producers care? No. But at the end of the day, my boss and I are like, we changed law. And it's still in there. It's still a little byline. Because obviously with all law things, all changes are in there. But we literally had to change provincial law to put a helicopter in the scene.
You changed the law of Canada for film.
Yeah, changed the law of Ontario. I love that. I'm waiting for a federal one. That hasn't happened yet.
That's the next step is the full federal law.
It's problem solving. No is an easy answer for people to give. And at some point it might be no, but you just try to find any way to work at it properly. Like, we didn't violate anything. We just found that there was a way to change that.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. And that's the fun of that sort of creativity is.
Fun at the end.
Yeah.
Very stressful during.
I'm sure.
Worried you're going to lose your job while it's happening. But yeah, sometimes you do have to go back and say, look, the answer is no.
Yeah.
There were sometimes other some places I remember on Shadowhunters they wanted to go to and it just didn't work. Mm. We couldn't do what they wanted. You know, you kind of go with it. But we were pretty lucky most times that we either got what we wanted or we were able to creatively find a way out.
Well, none of the locations that we were on ever felt as though it was a second choice or felt as though it was makeshift in any way, shape, or form.
Now the stress in the beginning of season two was when they said we want to go back to the boat. You know, it was two
I was going to ask about the boat. I was going to ask first about the boat.
The first boat was sold because there was a good span of time between seasons. Mm-hmm. They had sold it for scrap and it was being hauled, I believe, to Turkey. And I think it sank somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
They sank it in the Atlantic?
They buy a lot of scrap boats and ship them overseas and they really buy a ton of insurance on them.
How did they get it out of the lake?
Sometimes they don't make it.
How did they get it out of the lake?
They just towed it.
To where? Oh, there's just like down a massive river somewhere out into the ocean?
So Lake Ontario is the bottom of the Great Lakes. Eventually, if you just kept going east, you get into the St. Lawrence Canal through Montreal and straight out to the Atlantic Ocean.
Wow, I didn't know that. I just assumed it was it's like a reservoir. No. Like there's way
in or out. So cargo, predominantly big ships go to Halifax about Montreal and they stop there to smaller ones like the ones we were on that go to Toronto, Hamilton, through the canals to Lake Erie. Up to they go all the way to Northern Ontario or Minnesota basically to drop off grain or
whatever.
So we were lucky to find another ship and hope that no one would notice on that by much that it was a completely different vessel.
I didn't notice. I was on both of those ships. I didn't fucking notice that it was a different.
I didn't
boat.
Notice.
I think there was like a crane missing, there was a crane on the second.
There
one.
There was a crane in the second boat. There wasn't on the first. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only thing I noticed though, because I literally fought underneath it. I had a fight scene under it, and I was like, I don't think this was here before, but I drink a lot, so who knows? Maybe it was. Maybe I just missed it. I don't know.
Well, for any Shadowhunters folks out there, if anyone ever finds the boat, maybe we'll have to have like a dive to the boat.
Yeah, scuba expedition.
Scuba expedition for the. The fun.
But tell us, John, tell us more about the boat debacle. So what's the process of finding not one, but two boats that can be used to film?
Very, very much. We were just fortunate at the time that both boats were basically moored for maintenance. Mm-hmm. And, both ship lines were open to us coming on there. Cause I mean, it's money for them for literally doing nothing.
Yeah.
Both have been film friendly in the past. Extremely lucky that both boats were just moored there. Basically, I think the first one didn't even have an engine.
Oh wow!
Right. Disabled. Yeah, it was just tied. It was basically just tied up. And the second one too. It was down for repairs that were going to take a couple of months.
Oh, I see.
Wow.
Otherwise, we would have had to probably go to like, the next place over would have been Hamilton that might have had a boat, but just having one in the exact same spot, well, by a couple of feet, was just completely, good luck for us to start the season that way.
Well, and that just happened to have a beautiful skyline of Toronto that you can delete CN Tower and pop in the Empire State Building and you're good to go.
Yeah. My favorite is when shows forget to do that.
Yeah.
Pan across.
There's so few of them in our show, but every now and then you see like the tea from a Tim Hortons and I'm like, I ain't got those in New York.
Oh, no. So when we show stuff on screen, we have to get clearance from the studio what names we could show. But the problem is a lot of the clearance that we use is from the States. So they don't recognize Canadian brands. Like there's one scene where you guys you're walking and there's a Second Cup sign, and a Tim Hortons.
Yeah.
And we're just like, oh. They wouldn't let it. They didn't have an issue with it, but we're just sitting there going, this just screams Toronto.
I just found this out I was just working for Netflix. I guess because it's streaming or because Netflix has a deal in particular, I can't remember what the reason was, but they said Netflix doesn't have to, you don't have to do that. You don't have to get clearance for anything.
What?
We were using iPhones. We were all using Apple products. We didn't have to pay Apple anything.
Yeah, clearance is a weird thing. It's if you line up four clearance people and ask them the same question, you're going to get four different answers.
Right.
Because if I was to tell you, are you allowed to use Major League Football's names, the players, the teams in a movie?
Mm-hmm.
You'd say, without their permission, you'd say no. But there's an entire movie called Concussion where they never once asked for permission.
Right.
And literally because they didn't actually lie, it was all factual, they were allowed to get away with it.
Wow. Mm.
Well, I wonder if that must be very fluid now as well. Because I know my brother is a coach for the England rugby team in the R&D department. And I know they're bringing in versions of technology now with different things where they talk about things like this. If you do something like this, like if you move forward with this technology, the information from this will belong to the player, not to the club. It will belong to the player directly. So when you start doing like with the movement of things like NFTs and whatever, if you NFT a touchdown from a football team or whatever, then you can't reference that again. You can't reference the guy's name without having to pay them because they have monetized their one thing and made it, theirs, which is really interesting. I can't imagine that you're wrong in any way because four different people will give four different answers.
Clearance is what drives us nuts. Yeah, no, clearance is when they start involving our department. We just kind of lose our minds because it's really it's someone else to deal with it. I can get a sign off from the owner of the building. You want to change the sign? Great. Yeah. But please don't ask me to get clearance from Subway.
Right, yeah.
Just call it something else.
Suddenly, Alex
just walking down the street eating a sandwich.
We had a scene like that. We had a scene in the morning where Matt wanted to finish his coffee and they were like, just drink it in the scene. And like, we're walking onto the scene. They were like, wait. And they ran off and they put a heat sleeve on it. Cover up the logo, whatever the coffee cup was. I'm like, hey, fine, go. Do you think?
Yeah.
And nobody wants a Game of Thrones Starbucks moment where they, I can only imagine, had to pay Starbucks a fortune to get that in. Or to pay them off, like it was an accident.
Yeah.
But most times nothing ever happens.
Right.
It's free, unless you're doing something disparagingly with the brand, most companies really don't care.
They're like, honestly, it was free advertising.
Great branding for them. Yeah, like Starbucks, so good that it was in a mythical land 1,600 years ago.
Exactly. It's the best advert. Starks Bucks.
That's very good, Kat. Very good.
Sometimes. Not just a hat rack,
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...with zero qualifications...
She had a Harvard plaque.
...tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion. ...that this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million.
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You, John, are one of the folks on the crew that have really been active on Twitter and with the fandom and all of that. So, as you know, the Shadow Fam is a magical being of its own, and they are angels on this earth. So let's talk a little bit about your experience with the fandom and, being at the Comic-Cons and what's that been like for you?
Okay, so first and foremost, I am a fan of stuff. Like, I am still, I consume the content. I attend, New York and San Diego Comic-Con. I run a panel at San Diego about location scouting. But being immersed within the people that, pay my salary. But the Shadow Fam, they've always been, pleasant. They've got great hearts. I've been happy to meet a few of them, and a lot of them in person. And not just, they're not rude on social media. They're engaging. Because I've been at all the appearances, like all three New Yorks, the two San Diegos, and the amount of times I'll get the weirdest one was the third time at New York when we were at Madison Square Gardens. They had everyone show up early in corrals, like pens, to keep the queue going. So I was in one of the first ones, and I start getting Twitter notices asking if that's me there. And I'm like, yes. And people were respectful enough not to start pointing out that I'm in the crowd. Mm-hmm. Not that I wouldn't mind, but they've been great. I still communicate with quite a few of them. Half my Instagram is Shadowhunters fans. Yeah. There was a time it turned out I was in London for a conference when you guys had a convention and ended up meeting a few people that I've met before.
Oh, nice.
They're great. You still stay in touch with a few of them. I mean, I still send them Christmas cards.
Oh, they that's reach really out all the sweet. Time.
Aww.
Yeah, I mean, they've been good to me, and it's been fun being part of the community. Yeah.
I love the Shadow Fam.
They're great. I mean, I can never say, I know the definition of, fan comes from fanatic, but
it does, yeah. But I don't think that's necessarily the apt definition anymore. I think we Kat and I both have experienced our fair share of the fanatic version of it, which is... I don't know if it's the same with you, Kat, but with me, very often it's partners that get the rough end of it. Like my girlfriend gets the rough end of it every now and then. And then you sort of go through it and you go, this is like three people of the millions that we've met and the millions that watch the show over the course of, like, I'm not going to, and I'm sort of, this is my old age coming through. It's my gray hairs are adding to my knowledge. I saw this thing recently as I'm not giving you the privilege to take away any of my happiness. You don't deserve that. There's so many people who strive for our happiness and we strive for theirs and just makes the world go round, the full yin and yang of the world. This minute percentage of people that want to be negative in some way, I'm not giving you permission to take my happiness away from me anymore.
No.
That's not yours. You don't get that privilege. It's not for you. And like you say, the vast majority of people have been so supportive, without whom we wouldn't be here, not only doing the podcast, we wouldn't have done the show. The show wouldn't have kept going without people who enjoyed it.
It's true.
And that was always the fun of going to all those conventions and seeing the fan base grow, you know, moving from the basement of the Javits to now Square Gardens. Yeah. And that many people just that loved the show were involved in it. It's still great when I go into a convention and still see people dressed up.
Yeah,
it's like phenomenal. The most of you. It's so wild. Well, and what's incredible too is that, you know, you get to see over the years, Dom and I have met, and I'm sure you too have seen this. We've met so many folks who, you know, they were 14 or 15 or 12 when we first met them. And now we still, every year we go to conventions or see on Twitter, we get to hear about their, you know, university or their jobs or the progress they've made in their life, or get to watch these people grow into themselves in so many amazing ways and see the fandom support them and see these friendships grow and blossom and
develop, you know, new through people like brought people in who,
and develop. Yeah.
Yeah. Like people who've connected through a mutual love of either these stories or, you know, what you guys did, the locations, whatever it is, like seeing people develop these relationships within that is really sweet. Like we've seen people get into romantic relationships from like two people who are separate at these conventions that we've gone to. And then all of a sudden they're holding hands and we're like on a panel, like, hey, are those two? I think those two are hanging out now. And then they ask us a question. I'm like, shit, I wasn't listening. I'm sorry. I was paying attention to whatever's going on here.
But it's a fandom that it's never like on most, I've never had been on a show that had it. That was such passion and became its own community and published books and stuck together and, you know, just the whole campaign to try to save the show. We still
have a bench in New York in Central Park that's dedicated to us, which is wild. I still haven't seen that. I used to walk down there all the time.
It's humbling.
It is humbling, isn't it? It really is.
Because I've walked past it a few times and it's like, that's just odd, but in a great way. Like nothing I've worked on has a bench that the studio realized how much fandom loved the show, a product, and decided to put money towards something.
Well, that's why we came up with that idea. You know, we were ending the show and I was talking to Harry about it and we're like, well, what if we did, you know, what if we did this and made a, you know, not a monument, but a spot that people could go and remember the show in the place that it existed. And the studio was kind enough to help out. So
I didn't realize that.
I didn't realize the studio put towards it. That's really nice.
Yeah. Freeform came in and helped us with it. Cause it, you know, it's really not, sweet. It's not a small expenditure.
Oh, I'm sure.
No.
I'm sure. No,
it's also a place where fans can always know where to meet when they're in if they want.
We did it recently. I was gone already from New York, but we did it at this convention. We had a convention that sort of fell apart.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm aware. I had my plane ticket and hotel, and I had already checked the flight in. And it was literally that morning when I'm getting tweets from fans that know me. And I'm like, what's going? Okay. And I reached out. I'm like, I have this ticket. I could go. I just feel guilty because it's your money that I'm going to be spending. So try to be supportive on what you guys did. There was brilliant.
I was, you know, making lemonade. That's really all we did. But so the first day I met fans in the hotel and then I left because I had to go to a bachelor party. I was only supposed to do that one day anyway. And then the next day everyone met around the bench. That's where Anna and everyone went and saw everyone was like, look, we're going to meet around the bench. Let's go and hang out and, you know, do what we can. And it was nice. Yeah. I mean, it was mental. It was a mental, mental thing to happen, but it was nice to have, like you say, this is sort of our spot in New York, which is cool.
That was horrible. At least something good came out of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's what the Shadow Fam does. You know, anytime something happens, good or bad, they always find a way to make something good out of it. And I will forever be in awe of this community.
John, I got to ask, what are your favorite locations? Like, I don't want to say one because that seems like an impossible. Look at me, like, trying to do stuff on my laptop whilst also speaking into the microphone. I look like a fucking idiot. Let's say top two or top three. Is that too much?
You're going to hate the first one. No, because anyone who knows me in town is going to expect the answer. I am a very big fan of the former Hearn Generating Station.
Fuck that. Fuck the Hearn. How have we not spoken about the Hearn yet?
It looks beautiful.
It looks amazing.
It looks beautiful.
I've spent a massive amount of my career in that building.
Everyone has. It's so funny. We had Zach Levi. Do you remember when we saw Zach Levi come up?
Yeah.
And he was like, "We're filming in this place tomorrow. It's like the Hearn." And I was like, "You're filming in the
We're
Hearn."
Like, dress oh, no.
warm. He was like, "Dude, I'm in the super suit." I was like, "I don't know what to tell you, bro. Try and stay as warm as you can."
We've got a show where we rented it for a year.
No,
what show is that?
The second season of C for Apple TV. It only appears in the first couple of episodes. We literally built where those columns are, like where the tunnel-y aspect of it is.
Yeah.
We literally turned that into 10 blocks of a city 400 years in the future that with like two-story buildings and rope wires. And
400 years in the future?
So the C was the Jason Momoa series on Apple where there's a viral, a plague that turns everybody blind. And then you now cut into the future where everyone's basically blind and beating each other with swords and sticks.
Oh, man.
Their technology doesn't really exist. Shot. It's all...
That sounds like a cool show.
The first season was shot in Vancouver. They'd season 2 and 3 in Ontario. But the idea was it was an entire world where everyone is sightless. So, you know, there's ropes where they can use their sticks to get around.
Oh.
And the designer... It was actually another show where we were all very open and collaborative and creative because we were building a world.
Mm.
But they needed this big space that worked. And the designer came in and the producers, they... love the space because we could build a world.
It is gothically beautiful and can become anything, really.
Is it the prettiest place in the world? No, but you take any director in that place, they all lose their minds.
Well, it's just the way the light bounces and there's so many lines and angles and shadows and, you know,
I mean,
ravens.
Even season one, we used the outside for Renwick's.
Yeah.
We needed a building that looked it has multiple of looks. That's why I like it. Trying to think of what else. I mean, the conservation area that we did, Lake Lynn, and also the garden, Rockwood, is another favorite of mine just because topographically it's very different. It always looks good on camera. The ruins work great.
The whole Lake Lynn thing, we were up there for like a week, weren't we? And it was just like every day was gorgeous. We'd get there in the mornings and like the ice had covered everything. There were like ferrets running across the ice and it was just like it was the most breathtakingly beautiful place. And then the ice melted and we got to see the lake and... Oh, it was absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
And we got to go back and spend 2 nights with fake snow and Cat in the Red Gown.
Well, and even the there was that one scene we were chasing at Golden Hour at sunset with that fight scene in the woods and just the way that the sun was setting through the trees and how the drone got to drive through and everything. Yeah. The drone got to drive?
Cedar and limestone and karst rock.
Through the air.
It looks great. Yeah.
So fly. Air drive. It got to fly.
Yes.
That's the word you're looking for, Catherine.
Drive on air. Or fly.
Good Lord.
I don't know. I'm not a drone operator. I don't know the terminology.
If I had to pick two, those would be the two. But we were lucky to be in a lot of really visually great places that just worked.
Yeah. Well, all thanks to you, clearly.
Yeah.
Thanks to I'm one of many, many people that make it all happen. I mean,
thanks to you and your team.
That works with me. But even then, it's just, you know, what's on screen. It's the set dressing. It's the cinematography. It's the special effects. We're all cogs in this machine that put this tableau up there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so we've got to marry up.
Yeah, that's what the heart and soul of Shadowhunters was. Everyone committed to that. You know, I'm, you know, being a cog in the machine, but also trying to help the machine run better simultaneously.
Yep.
And I think that's why you see so many incredible things happen in that show.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, like I said, even this, you know, the church that we did with the Church of Talta with that ballroom scene that we had to dress every single time we went into that place.
Oh my God, which is also right. Yes, that was, I got to see so little of that because I had the fucking head on the whole time. I could see like much through the eyes.
Yeah. We had to dress and build that every time.
Oh my God, that's right.
But oddly enough, that was a recycled location. That was the same one we used in the very first episode as the Brooklyn Academy of Art.
No, it wasn't.
Wow.
Was it really?
Yep.
That was the same set?
Same church, same building.
I had no idea.
That's insane.
Wow. Unbelievable. Like I say,
again,
I saw very little.
We were asked to find something in Matt's eyes that was a decrepit ballroom, and we just couldn't find anything that worked perfectly. But this, we could make that space work.
Yeah.
And I mean, I remember it took them like 8 hours of just putting the cobwebs in.
Yeah.
Wow.
Cobwebs.
So every time it appeared in a script again, it was just like, oh Lord.
Oh no.
We have to do it again. Because you want it to look, well, it's more just having to match what was seen before.
Totally. Right. And tell John, tell the people at home how you do cobwebs. Because obviously we don't fucking leave
weird
spiders.
Gun hose that's like, it's like this nozzle. It's almost like a insulating foam sprayer, and they just sprays out like strands of, I don't know what the liquid is, and it dries up. It's like hot glue being injected. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait.
It's like a hot glue gun.
I didn't know this.
Because the cobwebs there were like over everything from the air coming down. It was like two guys in respirators just spraying all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then someone had to come in with dust to age it all and dust it.
Oh, I remember the dust. We had, I don't know if you remember, Dom, in Lilith's apartment, everything was covered in a layer of dust and had to be redusted constantly.
All the time. Like when you take a step.
We couldn't just shake the rafters?
Yeah.
No, I guess you don't the rafters.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, man. Yeah, no kidding. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us. Before we let you go, I just want to ask, what's next? What's coming up? What are you headed towards? Or what do you want to do? What's it like? Yeah. Answer both.
I want to work. Job.
Yeah. me too.
Dream job. My dream job went to New York this year. I can't say it out loud. There was a Marvel show that was going to be coming up here that
ended
up, because the cast didn't want to relocate, ended up going to New York.
They don't know Toronto. Toronto's amazing.
Yeah, the studio was all for it. It was just the one of the key actors really is insisted on not leaving New York City.
Got it.
That's a shame. I can't fault them.
I guess.
I'm happy to be, I'm, you know, content to be employed.
Yeah.
I've been lucky enough to be consistently working. It's just a bit of a quiet time right now. So I'm just waiting to see what's next.
Yeah.
It's a couple of projects. I'm waiting to see whether they're ready to go. And I can,
it's so funny trying to explain to people like what a quiet period is. Like people not in the industry who are like, oh, I just heard that they're doing this. You should audition for this. And I'm like, yeah, you just hearing that it's happening means it's like in the beginning stages of pre-production. That's not going to hit my desk for a year. You know what I mean? It's not going to start filming for a year and a half, like there's, or 2 years even. Like that's not, it's just not how this works. January.
Or by the time you've heard it, they've already started.
Exactly. It's already in the can, and just sitting there. Yeah.
It's done. Yeah. They're like,
well, that's the thing is, it's pre-pandemic, we had the artificial streaming boom, which is why it was busy. And then COVID hit. And then afterwards, it was just insanity. And now we've gone back to what the rhythm used to be. I mean, I've been doing this long enough to know December, January, you don't really work. February, March, it's cyclical.
Starts to pick up,
Just getting back used to that.
Yeah.
But, good, you know, stuff, the pandemic changed.
Yeah, it changed quite a lot.
You know, we were in the middle of a show.
Wow.
We dropped tools. They kept me employed part-time the whole time because we literally just walked away from million-dollar sets.
Holy moly.
That were all out. Like, C was a very huge show with a lot of massive sets that were built. They just walked away. And then we came back and hellishly took what was supposed to be a television series. And decided we wanted to shoot it with one director and do it like a feature.
Oof. Mm. How many episodes did you do?
8. Okay. 16 days each.
Wow.
So we also then had season 2. They decided, okay, we're going to block shoot it like a feature. So 174 days. By the way, you have 4 weeks of prep.
Wow.
Holy moly.
Well, Jason Momoa's schedule was so tight that we had to shoot him up too.
Yeah.
It was a slog. I mean, that job, those 2 seasons was 27 months of work.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
But hey, working, you know, working.
Somehow
working.
You accomplished it, though. That's the thing. The film and television.
It was a huge show with big explosions and big stuff. And, you know, we were outside a lot, which was nice, especially in the winter.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, I can't quite describe it to people. Like shooting in New York and they're bringing me my jacket every time it like gets close to 0 Celsius. I'm like, don't worry about it, guys.
Yeah.
4 years. I did 4 years in Toronto. Don't worry about it.
So there's a conference in London, a location conference in London called Focus. I go to every year because I belong to a trade association. And it's in the first week. It's the first Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday of December. Mm-hmm. And I show up there and everyone there is in these thick winter coats. And I'm like, it's the springtime. What are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
It's nice. Yeah. You're in your shorts, like ready to go for the beach.
Like you're wearing a Canada snow goose. I don't even own one of those.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was in Santa Fe shooting, you know, a Western this year. And yes, it's cold, but, you know, I'm wearing so much fabric on that show. I'm like, guys, come on. I have so many layers. This is nothing. This is balmy.
I was in Atlanta right before Christmas and everyone there is complaining how cold it is. And like, it's 1 degree Celsius. What are you talking about?
Yeah, we're good. Yeah, don't worry about it. Anyway, John, thank you so much for being a part of this with us. Thank you for coming on and sharing your stories. We really appreciate it. I mean, for us, it means such a lot because people get this insight about the geniuses who really put this show together. So thank you for not only being on the podcast, but for being such an integral part of our show.
Absolutely.
It's been my pleasure. It's been a highlight for me.
It means so much to share these stories because Dom and I can talk about it all we want and be like, oh, John told us this and John said that and he did this thing. But to hear it from you and to hear your perspective and your insight, and I learned so much today. Thanks so much.
I'm happy to talk about this show anytime. If you ever have questions and complaints about why we shot stuff in war, I can always give you the answer.
You know what? Next time we do a mailbag episode. All right, please. Angels, here's the deal. Next time we do a mailbag episode, if you have any questions for John, let us know.
And we'll forward dirty drama that was in decisions for what was made and when and where and why certain people. If people understand, we're startup early enough that we're there when they discuss why certain people get hired.
Wow. Can
you tell? Do we want to know?
Especially in season one, there was a lot of drama in season one that thankfully
I remember.
Away. Yep.
Some of it.
Yep.
That's why certain people weren't asked back.
We're going to go and we've got another episode to film right after this. But again, John, thank you so much.
Thank you, John. Well,
thank you for doing this. You too.
Bye.
Return to the Shadows is hosted and executive produced by me, Dominic Sherwood, and Catherine McNamara. Our executive producer is Ling Lee. Our senior producers are Liz Hayes and Diego Tapia. Our producer is Hannah Harris and Kristen Vermilia. And our intern is Sam Katz. Original music by Alex Kinsey, performed by Alex Kinsey and Catherine McNamara, and the episode was mixed by Seth Alansky.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.